So last time we were talking about wireless LAN technology, so the 802.11 standard by and large, and I don't know, some of the big takeaway points of it, it's concerning point-to-point connections, you're sharing the medium within a fairly localized area, and the predominant means of doing this is contention-based multiple access protocol. The protocol is slightly different from what you mean by contention-based wired protocol in the sense that not all the stations are going to get exactly the same picture of what's going on, and so we saw a few modifications that would help with that problem. And we also looked at some attempts to impose a quality of service mechanism on this contention-based protocol. So you have traffic put into classes, and then different classes are given different interframe spacings, different contention numbers, which means some classes will be able to transition the medium earlier than other classes. And once they have it, they go to all the transmission opportunities, you know, fixed amount of time to transmit whatever they need to transmit. So this gives a way of favoring certain classes over others, but it's still within the context of a contention-based system. So you can't really provide any guarantees for one versus the other. Okay, so today, and for the next few lectures, we're going to go back to cellular systems and what we're going to be doing essentially is stepping through the generations and saying a few about what the technical high points of each generation are. And so today we're going to be looking at second generation networks. And these basically send, you know, the main purpose of the second generation network was to provide a connection oriented service to send a digitized voice signal. So it's a fair ways from where we are now, but you can look at the generations then as evolutionary steps from this point. It might or might not be a good place to start in terms of understandability. All real cellular networks are quite complex. One thing you can argue maybe is that there's one purpose to this, and so to some extent maybe things are a little bit more straightforward for GSM than future net, you know, for next generation networks. And so might be worth spending some time and looking at the details of GSM. Now, when I say the details of GSM, the standard runs to thousands of pages, and there are whole books written on it. So we're obviously still only going to get an overview of the highlights of what goes on. But if you spend some time and think about what's going on in GSM networks, it might be, you know, again, but as we move on, it might be a little bit more. Okay. So we'll start with a little bit of this concept of evolution of cellular networks, you know, through the generations. Roughly speaking, there's a generation every 10 years. And then represents some fairly major change to the network. Then we'll get down to what are some of the details of GSM, and in particular We look at channel structures. So, how are the channels divided up, particularly between data and control signaling? The transmission system, so if we go back to what we said originally in the module, you have a lot of coding going on before you reach your radio link, so what are some of the coding schemes used? And then say a word about, again, just management of both the network and the connections provided by the network. Okay, so if we look at evolution, the first cellular networks were designed to deliver analog voice traffic, and these first appeared in the late 70s, early 80s. And this would have been, sort of again, a wireless alternative to the wired telephony network, which was also at that point dealing with analog signals. So one of the first standardizations was the AMPS cellular system by Bell Labs. And again, it was demonstrated, standardized, and initially the main purpose would be just sort of emergency communications, and then it later sort of expanded to sort of regular users. At that point in time, the standards weren't very standard in the sense that each region tended to develop their own version. Okay, so again, there were the USS standard, Russia, the Eastern Bloc, the Nordic countries had another standard, UK and Ireland had another standard. Mainland Europe had another standard, several standards, etc. Okay. And so what this meant was, naturally, there's not going to be much that was no interoperability, so you move within a country, but you can't move from country to country with your equipment. Okay, so these systems were extremely limited. Again, because of the standards, it only work in a fairly localized region. That might be the whole country. They didn't have huge capacity at all. But, so they proved the concept that this was actually something that people were interested in and thought was a good thing. So, by the 1990s, there were millions of people using these first generation systems. Okay, so the big change for second generation systems was that we moved from an analog to a digital signal. And so again, this was in conjunction with what was happening in the wired telephony network. And using digital signals, you can improve transmission quality, system capacity, and coverage, therefore. And you can also then support data services. Okay. The system was still voice oriented and circuit switched, so its primary goal was to carry voice transmissions. So, the next one who comes in is going to have to go back out and get a can of WD-40. So, again, there were a lot of 2G standards proposed. A lot of these can be distinguished by their multiplexing techniques. So, a good bulk of them were time division multiple axis. They're using time slots, but you did see the advent of code division multiple axis as well, so the spread spectrum techniques. And so I've said this today, we're going to go over GSM, and this was one of many standards, but it did grow to be the dominant 2G standard. Okay, so I changed the slide slightly just because 2G is on the way out. There's big debates about how long it's going to stay in the system of GSMs, I should say, is on the way out. But there's still billions of users worldwide. And again, I think it's sort of, you can have a look at everything, look at everything that's happened since it's sort of an evolutionary manner. Okay. Again, the advantages over an analog system are pretty clear. You can improve your call quality. You can provide some data services. And again, because of the dominance of a single standard, you can increase the range in which people So we're going to spend most of the lecture talking about sort of a few aspects of GSM. Again, there was an evolutionary process from 2G to 3G, and the main goal for that was to sort of give IP-based traffic a more centralized role. Okay, so to move away from a voice-dominated structure and to be able to provide better data rates. Okay. And so the goals were again, hopefully worldwide interoperability, support of mobile applications and as a support of both data and packet switch, data and voice services. Higher data rates and then things to be achieved by having higher spectrum efficiency. Okay. So again what we're going to look at is how that was the first effort to achieve that would be as a modification of GSM systems. And then so you modify your GSM systems and again maybe have more flexible use of the time slots to support data rates, some higher data rates, and you may or may not achieve the data rates required by the 3G standards, but again, you're coming closer than you would. And so the evolutionary process at the time was to two main competitors of GSM, which was involved in things like Edge, and in North America, CDMA, and all the things like CDMA 2000. Okay. Okay, so there were hiccups with, and so to provide an alternative to an evolutionary step, new spectrum was identified, so you can now change your air interface entirely in the new spectrum, and as a, this is a regulatory issue, spectra license, so there was a question of how the licensing would be allocated, and these slides way out of date as well at this point, but there were issues again with how the licensing was allocated. You know, if it went to auction or to general, companies paid too much for the licenses, and this hampered rollout because they then didn't have the capital to actually roll out the new equipment they needed. Okay. And this was sort of analogous to other places like Japan, which used a revenue sharing model for the licenses. Better position, and they rolled things out a lot sooner. Having said that, yeah, things are at this point out there. Okay. Now the 3G requirements specification. Is the IMT 2000, and so if you want to be called 3G, you have to be certified against this requirement. And so had constraints on throughput, and so the data rates change depending on whether you were moving or stationary, which is reasonable. Just want to support global mobility. So this independent radio interface technology. So you could have various technologies sort of on the same device. Switching between fixed and wireless communications, and support of packet switch services, and an acknowledgement that new applications were there, so you could support multimedia applications, which we again know are resource intensive and quality of service. And require quality of service guarantees. Okay. So, the ITU, International Telecommunications Union, set up the IMT 2000 to agree to standard. Agree to requirements, I should say, and then various bodies, industry groups, went to define standards that solutions that would satisfy. And again, within this, two main competitors within Europe, you had UMT, the 3GPP body, which proposed UMTS. We'll talk more about that later. And then in North America, you had 3GPP2, which proposed the CEMA 2000 standard. So, we're down to at least two standards, and as long as you have the radio technology, you will get worldwide coverage, and so usually just the devices could be built with multiple radio technologies. On the go is 4G, and it has a number of objectives beyond 3G. We want higher data rates, up to gigabit per second. We want support for heterogeneous networks, which means that users can move from various cellular to non-cellular technologies. And again, we provide more quality of service support, and again, make IP now central, so packet switching central to the service. Okay. So, IMT Advanced defines the requirements now, and 3GPP proposed the LTE advanced standard, and again, the US and Europe did converge finally on this standard. Okay. So, in following lectures, we'll have a look at sort of again what's interesting about 3G solutions and 4G solutions. Today, we're going to have a look at GSM. And again, GSM is quite complex. Any of these, no more complex than any other system, arguably less so. Any of these systems are extremely complex. Books are written about them. The standards run thousands of pages, etc. So we're just going to hit a few highlights today and try and get some idea of how these systems work. Okay, so again, we're providing a connection-oriented digital voice service. So, you can, of course, since it's a digital service, you can put those bits to whatever use you want, and you can the messaging, and then you can do data applications, but along those defined connections. It is the dominant 2G standard worldwide. Again, 2G is in decline, but it's not gone yet. It's debatable sort of how long what its current lifespan is. Okay. So once you start dealing with anything telephony, you start seeing lots of acronyms. And so, hopefully we'll keep those to the necessary minimum. And so, if we want to start with what are the main components of a GSM network, and we can think of it in terms of what's necessary for a user to make a connection. Yeah, we looked at this a bit just when we talked about abstract cellular systems. The first thing the user has to do is connect to a base station. Here they're called BTSs. And somehow that signal has to be relayed back to the main network. Typically, you have a group of BTSs, and they're controlled by a single base station controller, and that group, the base station controller, plus the number of these BTSs, forms the base station subsystem. Okay. And so that's concerned with managing the radio links within whatever region. So we now have the user connected to the network. You've now got to turn that single access connection into a connection back through the system to either the telephone network or the data network. Okay. And so again, there's a lot of control issues concerned with doing that, and those are all handled by the switching subsystem. And for the moment, we'll just draw your attention to the MSC. And so all of your BSCs connected to the MSC. And so that, again, is primarily in charge of making that connection and taking all from the base station out to the network and back the other direction. And finally, we also need sort of maintenance and operations for the network, things like billing, monitoring. And so those are handled by the subsystem. So the ones we're primarily concerned with is the base station subsystem. Switching subsystem. So each of those, each of the components then have sort of a certain coverage area. Responsible for users within a certain area. So obviously at the lowest level you have the BTS and it forms a cell. And so it's concerned with the users within its coverage area, so the cell. Beyond that, we have the area that's controlled by a single MSC, so that's going to have possibly multiple BSCs and then lots of cells within it. And so, again, the NFC is going to track users within this area. There's a page in the area, so you can track each of the page in the area. The MSC may have one or more staging areas. Okay, and then finally, you have multiple MSCs, and then whatever your overall coverage is. Your overall coverage could be a country or a region of the country, etc. So, in order to make a call, we're having to trace through a number of systems. So you have your mobile station next to the BPS, which connects to the BSC, which connects to an MSC. talks to various databases. If everything's okay, it then talks to a gateway, which sends the signal out, or if you reverse it back in. Okay. So each of these different interactions is covered by a defined interface. So that's how the signal is done and what everything signifies. Okay. So I've listed what the interface is dealing with. Fairly clear cut suggestion when you start with who's talking to who and why they need to talk to each other. So this is a radio interface. This transmission of whatever controller and data information needs to go back. MSCs may talk to each other for purposes of and the workloads and maybe an MSC. Send them control the link back into the network. Okay, so again, there are a whole pile of interfaces which again just handle control and data transmission through the network. So, just taking a little bit more detailed look at the various systems. We'll start with the base station subsystem. So again, we said that was comprised of a bunch of BPSs and then a base station controller. The BTSs are, again, providing the radio connection with the user, the mobile units. So they have to send and receive radio signals. They have to manage the radio connections, enable the user to actually get the connection. And they have to do specifics of the encoding and decoding of the principles. See how what options there are for how that encoding and decoding is done. So, again, do you think that that's, do you think that that degree in MS, the mobile user, and the ETS, that's your radio system? Okay. Then the data, voice data that you collect obviously has to be, again, sent back into the network. So the VSC manages a bunch of BTSs, and so it's responsible for configuring the cells, allocating resources to the cells, managing power level within for the BTSs, managing handover between different cells. And then again, as you go back into the network, that BSC is going to be connected to an MSC and a number of BSCs you'll be connected to the same MSC. Okay. So, again, the base station subsystem is mainly just, it manages that first link between the user and the network. But, again, if we want a connection-oriented system, we have to have some way of setting up these connections. And the switching subsystem is what's responsible for setting up an end-to-end connection. Okay. There are a number of elements to the switching subsystem. The core one is the MSC. And so the MSC is responsible for finding users, setting up calls, and maintaining connections. It's resource management, it does call handover, it manages encryption of data, and it interfaces to the external networks through the gateways. So, we're looking out towards the VSC, it's managing the VSCs, and then again, it's also moving data back through the network. Okay. So, there's a number of databases associated with the MSC that help it provide the various functionalities. The first of these is the home location register. And the home location register stores permanent data about subscribers. Okay. So,
what's the what are they needing for access?
Service requests or whatever services they're entitled to, whatever, again, information you need to call that a user. So, again, the users are moving through the network, and in order to find them, see wherever they currently are to deal with them. There is a visitor location register. The HLR is going to keep track of what VLR is currently associated to the user. MC has an associated ALR, and this stores the temporary information about it that's needed about a user while they're active within the network. There is also an authentication center, which verifies the user identity and ensures security, and an equipment identification register, which contains information about the status of equipment, so if it's lost, stolen,
databases will be combined.
Okay, so couple of other units. The message center manages messaging for GSM, and the mobile service node handles intelligent network services like call forwarding and things like that. Finally, there are two gateways, the GMSC connects the MSC to the telephone network, and the GIWU connects the MSC to the data network, or a data network. Okay. And again, the operation and maintenance center is responsible for monitoring the network, dealing with problems, and managing the home location register, and again, sort of back-end functions like billing. Okay. So, again, for our purposes, we're mainly interested in the base station controller and the base station subsystem and the switching subsystem. And so we can look at exactly what happens, how our process traces through. And so, again, when you turn on your phone, the first thing that has to happen is you access the network. So you have to let the network know you're there. So, accessing the network is a combination of notification and authentication, and so your user will have a SIM or a subscriber identity module card stored and which stores a key which identifies you as a subscriber. This is how you were identified within the home location register. And this will be again track roughly where you are in terms of what specific location register you're associated with. And
that service that you're inviting.
So when you power on the phone, the phone looks around to try and find an access point or BTS. It finds this because, again, the BTS is sending out a signal, and the phone knows how to look for that signal, and it will look for the strongest signal it finds. When it finds the signal, it responds to the BTS, and anchor is established, and visit the NFC, visit your location register, which gets information from the home location register, and identifies itself as the current location of the user. Okay, so you're now in the network. They know where you are, to what visitor location register you're associated with, so they know an area that you're in. If somebody wants to call you, the lead's going to come in through the GMSC. And when comes in, we look at the home location register to see if we can find the call. So, is there an entry for the visitor location register? And so, home location register also knows something about the status of the user, that they've already done have a number. In which case, you determine if you have a number, but not a map. Connected, or you know, they are there and you've got this location register. And so in this case, you give us a temporary number, and again, this temporary number is how the user will be identified for purposes of setting up. Okay, so now the MSC connected where the user is, looks for the BSC, and then within the BSC you have a page, all of the BTSs to that. And the phone, the page is successful, so it responds with BTS, and that's the internal response to the NFC. And at that point, you can make a connection from, again, through all these layers to the actual NFC. And if the user answers,
then you can create the path from,
again, user through the network to whoever called. Okay.
You're making a call, again. You send your request from the BTS to the BSC, and they attempt to establish a connection to the MSC.
The MSC checks your authentication, so are you authorized to make a call? If you are, connection is established, and you're between the mobile station and the MSC, and over that connection, you send the number. GMSC, and to the now callee, and assuming that sends a tone back to the user that we're now ringing, so we're now attempting to make the connection. Okay, so now what's the point of all of those? Again, it's just to indicate that, again, there's a lot of processing in order to establish this connection. There's a lot of processing at each of these different stages. Okay, so we're now going to concentrate on what's going on between the BTS and the user, the mobile station. And again, two things are happening. We're sending a lot of control information. So we have management that has to be done in terms of, again, the power aspects of the signal, what channel you're on, etc. We have to signal further on about setting up connections, etc. So there's a lot of control signals that have to be sent. And then, of course, there's data to be sent as well. So once you have that connection, you can send data along that connection. So the channel structure refers to how we distinguish between, how we decide, or how the system decides at any given point what type of information is being sent over the channel. And again, it's fairly complicated. After that, we'll look at the radio transmission system. To say something about how signal is being encoded. Okay. So what constitutes a channel for GSM? Well, it's a time division multiple access, frequency division multiple access scheme. And what that means is that your overall bandwidth is going to be divided into a number of subbands. So we're in two 25 megahertz wide bands, and each of these is going to be divided into 124 frequency intervals of 200 kilohertz each. Okay. So you get subchannels. Why do you have two different bands? Well, one's used for the uplink, one's used for the downlink. Okay. And if you recall, uplink is between the mobile station and the base station. Downlink is from the BTS to the user. Typically, the uplink and downlink channels are paired, and you use frequency division duplex to do this, and you have a separate frequency band in one direction or another.
within each of those bands.
Your signal is further divided up into time slots. And so each carrier has 8 time slots. So we go 0 through 7, 0 through 7, 0 through 7. And then, so the multiple access is realized by assigning a particular carrier frequency at a given time slot to a particular task, as I say to the user, but to a task at hand, really. Okay, so it's a little more complicated than just, you know, you have slot 1 at this frequency. So we'll see that.
Okay, so our basic unit that we have to work with is what we call a physical channel.
So it's just the time slot and frequency combination.
And again, we pair those up, and so the pair of channels differs in frequency, because again, it's an uplink downlink pair, and the uplink and downlink are on separate frequencies. And we also move the time slots numbering. Okay, so if it's on one number, then we delay it by the downlink direction. Increases the delay. And what this means is that your mobile station is never sending and receiving at the same time, so that makes it a little simpler for them.
Okay. So, again, at the simplest level, we've just got the unit we have to transmit with is just the time slot plus frequency.
And so, again, there's different sorts of things we want to transmit
along those time slot frequency pairs or combinations.
And so the different use to which you're putting the time slot and frequency pair is referred to as a logical channel.
So you might send data, it's one logical channel, and you might send a control signal, that's another logical channel.
Control is then
broken up into lots and lots of different things that we need to do.
Okay. And each one of these represents a different logical channel. Okay.
So our logical channels are performing specific tasks for the system. Okay.
And so the mapping between physical channel and logical channel is complex in the sense that any given time slot and frequency can be put to a number of different uses. So in this example, we're looking at the downlink direction, and we pick some carrier frequency, and then if we examine
examine any given time slots. This is time slot 5. Well, time slot 5 plus whatever frequency you've chosen gives you a physical channel. Now, depending on where you are in a sequence of in a cycle, that physical channel can be put to different use. So it can either be sending data or it can be sending control information. And the trick is to identify at any given time what use that channel is being put to. Okay. So, again, if you look at the mobile station making a connection request, then I said, you know, they would look for their BTS, their base station. And what they're doing is they're looking for a particular frequency and time slot. So the BTS is transmitting a signal on a certain frequency. And when it's found, that time slot as the user to know where they are in these sequences. Once they found that, they've identified the downlink, they can then identify the uplink, so just being in a pair, and the station can declare a need to set the call. And then again, a lot of signaling has to go on. This will be done in various other zero time slots, or possibly, you know, again, depending on the system.
Yeah, you may need to use other time slots as well. Okay. So, What are these uses that we need? Well, the easiest one is that we actually need to send data, either a voice signal or data transmission, and that happens on traffic channels. Then, again, we have a lot of control go on, so to arrange all these links. In order to accomplish that, we have broadcast channels, and they're just the base station communicating information to the users. So they're downlink direction only, and they're used for transmitting information about the network. Neighboring cells, so it's anything the user needs to know and want to do with the network. Okay. Then you have common control channels, which are used for call setup.
So, obviously, they can't be. They have to be shared among the users. And then you have dedicated control channels, which are associated
to a given call
in order to manage the connection during the call.
So once you have that connection, you can associate them specifically to that connection.
Okay. Again, traffic channels are going to carry either speech or data, and they can
full braids or half braids, depending on channel conditions. And we can also mix it in at control data. Now, again, what this means is that as you move through time, through these sets, so we have a frame, which is our 8 time slots, and as we move through time, the purpose which any individual time slots is put is changing. In order to know that the change doesn't happen just randomly, but within the time slots, a 26-frame multi-frame is defined, and within that frame, you know what's going on in each time slot. So, as an example, if we have a traffic channel, within a 26-frame multi-frame, frame 12 is going to be used, taken to actually transmit control information, as opposed to data. Okay. Broadcast channels are transmitted on the first frequency in the first time slot unless downlink direction only. And so, you know, again, that allows the users to identify where they are on cycle patterns. Okay, the broadcast channels are further subdivided according to purpose. So we have frequency correction channel, which allows the user to synchronize in terms of frequency. And that happens again every intervals every 10 frames. Then we have synchronization channel, so again allowing the user to synchronize with the system. That happens every 10 frames following frequency correction channel. And then we have broadcast control channel, which happens in frames 2 to 5, and transmits information that the users need about the network, including the cell, the ID, the channel availability. Okay. Now again, the common control channels are going to be used to try and set up the whole connection. And they're transmitted in the same slots as the broadcast control channels when that's not the ID, when they're not. Again, they're put to a number of purposes. There's the paging channel for locating about stations, the random access channel for replying to the paging, and access granted channel, which will indicate resource allocation to the user. Okay. So at that point, you'd have your connection set up. And be ready for dedicated connection.
control channels.
Okay, so again, common control channels and broadcast control channels are sharing the same slots, time slot and frequency, and so again, that's done in a regulated fashion. Here we define a 51 frame multi-frame, and depending where you are in that sequence, the slot will be put to different. Okay. So here we have our multi-frame, so we've got 51 slots. And we're on specific carrier frequency, and we're looking at what happens on slot 0. And again, you see that depending where you are in that slot, you're performing different functions. As long as the user is aware of the cycle, the signal information, then they can correctly interpret the information that's been sent in any given time slot. Okay. So the final bit of control information is the dedicated control channels, and they're set up on anything except the things that are dedicated to broadcast control. And again, they're subdivided for a number of purposes. So you have a standalone dedicated control channel. Manage connection, and as we set up before, the data connection. Our slow associated control channel, which regulates power and time, so the radio aspects of the signal, and that's going to be sent to the traffic slots. And our fast associated control channel, which is for more urgent messages and information from the time slots. Okay, so again, those pieces of information would be associated with frequency and time slot, and then within that frequency and time slot, you have the purpose and you have different signals multiplex. And so the user will be able to identify their portion of that information. Okay, so again, it takes some thinking to wrap your head around any of this, to really understand what's going on with all these control channels. It takes a lot of reading and thinking. What I'd like you to take out of it, again, are just what the various flavors are, and basically how the logic of how you can provide the logical channels. Okay. So, even within
Well, this idea of time slots, this doesn't completely capture what we're doing in the sense that it's possible to transmit slightly different things physically within the time slots. And so typically you have a bit which lasts a certain amount of time, so you get a certain bit rate. And that bit rate is going to correspond to data plus encoding, and is referred to as verse. And so, depending on what you're doing, the verse structure also differs. So, and then 48 bits, if you're having an access request, you actually have a lower number of bits. Time slot length is a combination of that bit rate plus number of bits. And so within that, we also have to ensure that there's synchronization, etc.
Okay, so you get a number of different bursts.
Okay. So, you now, so just to recap what's going on. We started out with our basic unit of transmission was 8 time slots. On a certain frequency constituting a frame. And again, physically, what's happening in each of those time slots is referred to as a burst and can vary slightly. And then, in order to accommodate different purposes to which these time slots and frames are being put, we've defined multi-frames, so sets of frames that, and again, the purpose varies depending on where you are in that set, and then once you're at the end, you move from set into a new multi-frame, everything repeats itself. Again, depending on what the purpose of the multi-frame is, two different sizes were specified, 26 and 51. And so what that means is that the whole cycle repeats itself after 26 times 51 frames. And the 26 times 51 frames is referred to as a super frame. And so, if you're tracking control channels, you have 26 frame multi-frames, which means you have to get 51 of those within a super frame. For broadcast channels, it's the reverse, you have 51 frames of multi-frame, and then 26 of these constitutes a super frame. Finally, a large number of these superframes creates the highest level, which is called a hyperframe. And the Piper Party is going to last 40 hours. And after this, the system clock resets itself. Okay. And it's used for the data encryption algorithm. That gives us a whole time hierarchy for GSMs and hyperframes, which within the hyperframe you've got superframes, which consists of the entire cycle through both data and control channels, and within that you have control and data multiframes, and each of those components consists single frames, which are our parser, our time slots. Within each time slot, again, depending on what you're doing, you're going to the construction of the burst, what you're actually transmitting is slightly different. Normal covers most of it, and then for certain control purposes, change something. We'll just have them first. Okay, and so that's just sort of a summary of all the different channels possible. Much to add on this, except again, every time I repeat, sits down all the way really on this first level. Okay, and again, just going through, you're going to start with the NS synchronizing to the base station via the broadcast control channels. You want to request connectivity on the common control channel. The base station will grant the access. And for whatever control information it needs to fully synchronize, determine where it should send its data. Okay. Authentication has to happen. And so again, all of the background, all of the further, all of the network setup into the main network. When that's happened, then the
MS
will take the traffic channels and be able to
transmit data on those traffic data channels. Okay, so like I say, it's complicated, but generally that's the method that's used for managing connections between user and base station. So, this I think is a good time to take a break. It's certainly the most complicated thing so we'll wrap up just the again.
That's again just what's going on that link between using the base station. We'll look at a few more aspects and improving the data and then say a little bit about managing the connections, not at that first link, but farther back into the network. So we'll take a break there, deep breath, and we'll return to this in about 15 minutes.